So, for our final presentation of the day, we have a panel. Legality. Could we be in trouble? Bill Scannell is going to be moderating this.
Good afternoon. I'm Bill Scannell. And the topic for today is legality. Could we be in trouble? And I think that the better question is, could you be in trouble, since you are the guys out there committing the crime, possibly, of writing code? We've got three people on our panel today. That's true. It's not only a good story, it's a true story. We've got quite an interesting group of people here on our panel. I'll go from my left to right. On the far end is Mr. Fred von Lohmann. He is a senior staff attorney with the EFF, the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. They made him check his white hat at the door. He's an intellectual property specialist. Seated next to Fred, a man who needs little introduction, Mr. Phil Zimmerman. A man who knows a thing or three about bringing crypto to the masses. As an aside, all four of us, it turns out, are Mac users. We run OS X, so if anybody wants to actually figure out a useful way for us to use PGP or any of its OS X byproducts, please feel free to contact any of us after the show. Seated next to Phil is Mr. John Callis. Excellent. John's an old PGP guy, currently working right now as a senior systems architect with Wave Systems, and an all-around pretty cool guy. I've watched way too many panel discussions, and I always really hated it when the moderator started out saying, right, well, now we're going to have you all give a five-minute introductory statement, and it carries on, and it's a little too boring. So I think we should just cut straight to the chase and go to Fred and really get this ball rolling, because Fred, there have been a lot of cases, the EFF has been fighting the good fight, but let's face it, it hasn't been looking very good. We seem to be very, very good at losing cases. So are we and are you wasting your time fighting these cases in court? Where do things stand right now, and where are we heading?
Well, let's just remember, crypto was a long fight and not one that we lost. I wouldn't jump to any conclusions about whether the war is over. It certainly isn't. I want to talk specifically today, sort of focus on the legal risks surrounding peer-to-peer file sharing, specifically because I am counsel, EFF is counsel to the folks who build Morpheus. I actually just yesterday received about 100 pages of briefs from the 28 media companies that are suing the vendors of Morpheus, including their 14 lawyers and $50 million legal war chest. So it is serious business out there. The single best piece of advice in terms of hoping that the tide turns, certainly the legal outcome of the Napster fight was not terribly encouraging, although I will note one that we were not involved in. The single most important piece of advice that comes out of that, I think, is that if you are building any tool that can be or is likely to be used by a large number of end users for unlawful purposes, or arguably unlawful purposes, it's incredibly important that you sit down and understand what the relevant legal standards are and build that into your system from an architectural point of view. I think many people understood and should understand that the Achilles heel for Napster was the fact that they ran a central indexing server that they had complete control over, that gave them detailed knowledge of exactly who was sharing what with whom, when, what they were searching for, what they were downloading, all the rest. Had that technical architectural mistake, and I don't mean that from an efficiency point of view, I understand completely why it was efficient from a technical point of view, But from a legal point of view, it was, I think, a critical error and one that they never did recover from. There are some guidelines that you can implement. I'll hopefully talk a little bit more about them. But think about your coding not just from the perspective of what is efficient, what will minimize network congestion, all the rest, but think also about what will keep me in the strongest legal position that I can be in, and feel free to call us.
But Fred, the U.S. government has a long-standing policy of going after people who are committing code crimes. And Phil, you have experienced in a unique personal way the anal probe of three-letter agencies. Now, this was before the DMCA and the Dr. Evil stepchild of the SSSCA. So maybe you can take some of the lessons that you've learned about committing code crime and how to get around it, and maybe we can then, maybe John can kick in, John as a guy who's out there writing code right now, and we can get a legal aspect, and then I can shut up and drink coffee.
I have a lot to say about this.
Unusual.
It's important that when you're developing code to do this kind of thing, that you have good gut legal instincts about how this would play from a prosecutor's point of view. Let me give you an example. In my own case, I was unable to acknowledge for many years that PGP was originally developed as a human rights project. Because if I did so, that would be tantamount to admitting that it was intended to be exported. In fact, PGP was intended to be exported. Me being the intender, I did intend it to be exported. The statute of limitations has run out now, and I can say whatever I want. But I could never say that. During the criminal investigation, I could never, ever say that. I was very disciplined about responding to questions from the audience, even questions from human rights workers in the audience, that PGP was intended to protect the domestic civil liberties of Americans, and if it got overseas, well, then all the better that it served another good, higher purpose over there, but its purpose was really, you know, to protect domestic civil liberties. You have to maintain a discipline about that. You have to have another use for this peer-to-peer technology besides stealing MP3s. You have to have, and there are other uses. In fact, I'm sure that I got in kind of late, so I missed some of the earlier presentations, but I'm sure that by now somebody has stood up here and pointed out other uses for it that benefit business. I think I've read articles about document distribution. Only one PDF file has to go through the low bandwidth pipe and to get to an office, and then everybody in the office can get their own copy over 100 base T from each other.
There's always Project Gutenberg.
Yeah. What is Project Gutenberg? No, wait. Let me get through this.
Yeah, no,
okay.
All right. How many people know what Project Gutenberg is?
I am so embarrassed.
No, but Phil, concretely, what lessons did you learn from this whole thing?
The lessons that I learned. Let me give you an example. When we published the source code in printed form, there were nuances of things. We had to develop special tools to make it scannable. We had to develop a special font that was easily scanned, because the first time we did it, we just used OCRB. And boy, it took 1,000 man hours to scan that thing in and correct by hand all the errors that we just didn't know how bad OCR was. So we had to develop special tools, special fonts, special everything. And there were nuances about, for example, what characters to use for the checksum. There was a checksum on every line of code. Well, I used hex for the checksum instead of radix 64 for the checksum, because program listings back in my early days of programming, and you know, back when we programmed frames, often had hex columns next to the source code of Fortran programs. You know, it looked normal. It looked like a normal program listing. C compilers generally don't list programs, but At least it would look like it was a program listing so that programmers could read source code from books and learn about programming style and stuff like that. Oh, and these numbers next to it, I don't know what those are, but probably the compiler produced those. It's a matter of optics. Now, the other programmers working on it with me, Mark Weaver, for example, he's a good engineer, and he thought, well, let's make it radix 64. We get more error correction bits in the polynomial. It'll be better. And I said, yes, it would be better, but it would start to raise questions. Why is that there? Then we'd have to talk more about it being an error correction code. I seem to be belaboring this little point, but there's there's lots of little things like we put little dots in for spaces, but only the first space was just a space, and a run of spaces would have a little black dot in for the subsequent spaces. Why am I spending so much time talking about this anal thing? Because the instincts that you have as a software engineer are not the right instincts for getting something through a legal system. We wanted to make a program list in books that programmers could sit and read as programmers, as humans, not computers, and get programming style guidelines from. And having spaces between each, having a single space between each one, it makes it more readable if it's white instead of a little black. There's lots of little things like that. There's the discipline of responding to questions the right way, as if you were in a deposition all the time, to be able to hold your head high and say, this is for this purpose. You know, Eudora from Qualcomm had this technology for plugins that they developed. Now, they were not allowed to develop a plugin technology for calling crypto APIs, because at that time it was illegal to do that. So Eudora, the Eudora team at Qualcomm decided that they would make it possible to call plugins to do all kinds of stupid things that nobody would ever want to do, like translate text files into foreign languages, or check the spelling, or capitalize all the letters, or, you know, change everything to Pig Latin, or God knows what.
So I have to interrupt, because the Rote 13 encryption in Eudora helped Adobe considerably in the Scigliato
The only reason case. Why they did that was to make a legal channel for them to put the real purpose, which was to put real crypto API in so they could call PGP plugins. I didn't know what the time budget is, so I guess I ran over that.
No, you're doing fine.
Okay.
But John, you've been writing code for donkey's years. How did you turn yourself from being a coder and writing crypto to having a lot of the legal issues that Phil and Fred have been talking about as you're writing?
Okay. I worked with Phil for a number of years at PGP, and when we were there, he was CTO and I was chief scientist. And one of the things that ended up happening was that because there were still a lot of issues with what Phil could and could not say, I was the guy who got pushed in front of the government. And this, you know, you have not heard of my name being involved in one of these. And this is one of my great triumphs, is most people don't know who I am, and I like it that way. It's really good to be anonymous in this way. When you're a technical person, there's a tendency to look at things in terms of logic, in terms of how you would write a program, and the law doesn't work that way. The law has its own sense. It is not a state machine. It is not a logical thing that works the way that code works. It does have, though, its own sense. Some people have a knack for that, and some people don't. If you don't have a knack for that, get yourself a lawyer. I mean, you need somebody to do that.
You do have the knack for that.
if you do have, you still need one. But also, you need to be able to pick the right sort of lawyer. There are lawyers whose goal in life is to tell you not to do things. They will tell you how to be safe. And they will always tell you whenever you want to stray off into the gray area, don't do that, because that would be dangerous. And then there are lawyers who will tell you how to get away with stuff. And if you want to get away with stuff, you want one of those lawyers. The publishing project that we did at PGP was originally the idea over a cocktail party between our then VP of engineering, Carolyn Turbefill, and Roz Thompson, who's one of the best export lawyers around, and if you need to do export stuff, you should like talk to Roz. But they were sitting around thinking that, well, you know, the export laws said explicitly in them, printed material, including source code, is exempt from these regulations. And the ITAR said that, and the EAR said that, and that's a direct quote. I memorized that. So the idea then became, well, if printed material is exempt, then if you printed it out, you could get it out. And this led down the entire path to getting...
We've quoted that law on the cover of the books.
Yeah. So this, you had to understand this sense. Was it as long as it was printed, it was okay? Similarly, when you're dealing with the things that are out now, like, for example, the DMCA, one of the things, Elcomsoft made a mistake. And one of the mistakes that they made was that they said, this is not a quote, this is a paraphrase, hi, we've got this great program and it will let you break into an ebook. No. That's bad. That's bad. An example of what you really want to do is you can go out on the web today and you can find delivered to you dehydrated, drug-free urine. Do not use this to reconstitute it and beat a drug test. That is illegal. They tell you, no, not for this use. If you do that and get in trouble, don't come to us. This is for experimentation purposes. It's for whatever you want to do with it, but it's not for beating a drug test. If you wrote a code that said, if you wrote a program and you said, this allows you to test the encryption and the security on your ebooks, it allows you to if you're a law enforcement agency, do that. Because Elcomsoft was very smart in the last thing they did for Sklarov was that they pointed out all of the people who used their program for legitimate uses.
Including the FBI.
Yeah, if they said, for legitimate purposes only, they would have had a much better case than if they said, oh, this lets you break into an ebook. This is the sort of thing that you have to do. It goes directly back to what Phil was saying. You have to understand that when you make something that is questionable, you need to know, is it on this side of the line or is it on that side of the line? And you want to keep it on the good side of the line and don't talk about the other side of the line uses that you could do this. Similarly, Apple did... Very recently, they came out with their iPod, which is, you know, a little MP3 player. And they said, do not use this to steal MP3s.
Because that would be wrong.
Right. And they didn't put any DRM in it. What they said was, be an adult, don't steal, that's bad, buy our product.
But John, to pick up from what you're saying... You're a coder who's had to legalize your brain while you're working. Fred, I'm really interested to know how you as an attorney have had to codify your brain, because I'm sure three-quarters of the people out here have Jennifer Granick's cell phone on speed dial. The president of the EFF.
No.
Right.
Jennifer's at Stanford. Oh. Sherry Steele is our executive.
Sherry, excuse me.
But yeah, Jennifer is
She's the woman.
That's right.
Right.
So.
But first of all, what kinds of things can you impart to people out here who are writing code to give them some general guidelines so that they can actually walk away with concrete stuff that they can think about first? And second, when do they need to pick up the phone?
Well, to answer the first question, let me give a couple of very concrete things that you should think about. The first one is that there is something that we at EFF published a while ago, back in the fall, called the P2P Copyright White Paper. And if you plug in P2P Copyright White Paper into Google, it will be the first hit. It's our best effort, my best effort, to try to explain the basic contours of copyright law as applied to peer-to-peer file sharing systems. My best effort to try to introduce you to legal, you know, get the legal intuition that Phil and John have been talking about. So I would first highly recommend that you read that. I wrote it in hopes that it would be understandable and aimed at the developer community. So hopefully it's not too impenetrably legal. The second thing I think you should think about is, as I think Phil or John mentioned, if you're coding a product that you think may be misused by some of your end users, the proper attitude to take while working on that product is that every single thing you do, say, email you send will be delivered onto the desk of an MPAA lawyer sooner or later. So when you do this work, imagine that there is an MPAA lawyer sitting at your elbow at all times.
That's right.
Because the truth is that... Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Good idea. Exactly. Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far, but don't, unless you have an attorney and your attorney has described to you in some detail what constitutes a privileged communication, don't leap to the conclusion that just because you're sending a piece of email to somebody who vaguely knows a lawyer who you intend to call someday, that that constitutes privileged communication. The safe thing to assume is unless a lawyer tells you what you're about to say is privileged, the MPAA lawyer is sitting there at your elbow reading it. And the reality is, in discovery, they will get every email. And yes, you can encrypt it, but if you encrypt it and don't disclose it, that may give rise to a sense that you have something to hide, God forbid.
You might even get your hard disk and get stuff that's undeleted sectors
that
contain privileged communication, but, you know,
right.
You can't.
Yeah, they can do forensic analysis. The point is, don't assume that, oh, I'm going to whisper with my friends about how this is really all about toppling the record industry and no one will ever find out. That's simply not a likely result. Every person you send an email to, every person you ever talked about in a project to, can be deposed and, you know, forced to sit in a chair and answer a lot of questions from lawyers. And if they lie, it will just end up making you look bad because the stories will look inconsistent. So
don't tell Ryan Lackey.
So think in those terms. Think in terms of, do I understand what the law is, and do I understand that what I'm doing has a sound legal basis? If you are developing new network tools that have lots of great uses, and, of course, some illegitimate uses, the same way the photocopier does, the same way web servers do, that's one thing. And you should comport yourself that way, and you should be designing your code that way. Napster, the entire system was designed to focus solely on MP3s, solely to be about music. That was their whole pitch. That's not the kind of approach you take if you assume an RIAA lawyer is at your elbow the whole time. The third thing to keep in mind, and to reinforce my first two messages, is you can be named personally in a copyright lawsuit based on what you code. A lot of people think, oh, well, there's no company, thus there's no one for them to sue. Well, yeah, there is. There's you. There's the actual people developing the code. You can be sued personally if they can show you knew that it was being used for infringement and that you were... involved in a substantial way, something to think about.
I want to jump in just for a minute on here, too. It's actually to your benefit to be working for a company, well, a corporation, because this is why corporations exist, is that corporations exist to take liability away from individuals. So you would actually be better off if you are working something incorporating and doing your work as work for hire for the corporation, which you happen to own 85% of.
I'm going to insert a caution on that. While that is true in almost everything in the world, for example, if you have a lease for a building and it's your corporation and you breach it, well, then maybe they can't really go after you personally. That is not the rule in copyright liability. In copyright liability, there is no complicated piercing the corporate veil. There are lots of cases out there where the CEO or president of a company who owned 50% of the stock gets named and held personally liable for copyright infringement if he knew what the company was up to and was in a position to be in charge. So not count on corporate shells to be protection. Count on the fact that you understand the law and you think you have a good legal argument. But don't count on, I'm behind a shell corp and they won't reach me. Because in copyright, as many things in copyright, the old rules don't apply quite the way you might think.
And because there are so many yes, buts, and exceptions to the rule, when do people need to call an attorney?
Well, I like to think that, you know, you should think about these legal questions at the beginning, as you're figuring out the architecture for your code, rather than after the RIAA sues you, like, you know, as it did in the Napster case, and you lawyer up late. That's often much too late. I think you should try to involve lawyers in your very basic architectural choices. I know how horrific that is. but, you know, that's the reality. Now, of course, down the road, if you've done that and then you receive a notice or any other suggestion that copyright owners are taking notice of what you're up to, that's definitely the time to pick up the phone. Don't wait and say, you know, I got some letters from the RIAA, but I thought I'd ignore them for 6 months. That don't laugh.
But yes, this...
or, no, it's worse because your end user, God forbid, has performed an illegal operation, is what this is all about.
And to drive that point home, Phil, you again experienced the full-on U.S. government cavity check, United We Stand. What were the three... what were the three things that you, in retrospect... I mean, we're looking... It's almost what? It's what? Seven? Nine? No, what? 8 years ago? It's been a while.
Investigation?
Yeah.
Well, that was from the beginning of 93 to the beginning of 96.
It was a while ago, and you've had some time to reflect on that. What are the three biggest mistakes that you made that will back up what Fred's talking about, that you really need to pick up the phone and get a hold of someone that really knows what they're doing? Because you were flying on your own there for a while.
Yeah. Well, I didn't involve a criminal lawyer until there was a criminal investigation. And, I don't know... how I could have published PGP without attracting some problems, you know. It turns out that the government focused entirely on the events of June of 91, thinking that the crime was really in the initial export of PGP. But my biggest vulnerabilities, though, were over the next 15 months in developing the subsequent version of PGP, and I laid awake at night worrying about that. I guess maybe I would have made it so that we published it in a way that was just on a few domestic sites, not in any news groups, for example. Because at that time, I knew nothing about it. In fact, I didn't even know what a news group was. So when somebody told me that, oh, you could have U.S. only distribution of a news group item that you're sending out, I thought, oh, that's good. Well, please put that on. You know,
with the military exporting it for you.
Yeah.
It went out on a dot mil news group, by the way. That's how it got out
you
of
know,
the country.
But, you
just
know,
learned
having,
that today.
Having talked to my criminal lawyer almost every day for that 3 years, I developed a really good sense of what would happen at trial, you know. And, I mean, for example, when we published the books, we put on the cover of the book the exact law that says we're allowed to publish these books, on the cover. Why did we do that? I mean, it's kind of like hanging garlic or a crucifix to keep the vampires away. You know, I asked my lawyer about a lot of things like that, about, well, what could we introduce as evidence? And, well, the prosecutor will fight this. He'll try to exclude this as evidence because he'll say it's no defense or something like that. So I thought, how do you make it so that they can't exclude it? Well, you put it on Exhibit A that they want to use for their own case. So let's put it on the cover of the book, which would be Exhibit A for their case. So the jury couldn't possibly avoid seeing that on the cover of the Exhibit A, it says that we're allowed to publish this book. When it comes to a shooting war, where a prosecutor is looking at this and deciding whether or not to prosecute, he's going to look at this, and that's just one more thing out of all the other layered defenses. And I think thin-layered defenses, where you have multiple thin layers, is better than one thick one. So he would say, you know, that's going to be a problem come trial, you know. So one more reason why I don't even want to proceed with the case. So
do not piss off your lawyer.
Well, no, I pissed off my lawyers a lot, actually. But I guess I don't know if I can sum it up in one sentence lesson.
Okay.
But the recurring theme in the subsequent things that I did after the end of the criminal trial was to always try to do, and actually even no during. Did I say criminal trial? I meant to say criminal investigation. Does that during the investigation is you have to maintain a discipline. You have to say the right thing. You have to have a good. One of the big political things was that the entire computer industry was in favor of lifting the exports on cryptography. Now you don't really have that with this kind of peer-to-peer stuff so much. I mean, certainly there was an entire industry against Napster. So if you could figure out a way to try to have legitimate uses for peer-to-peer protocol that would have some economic benefit to American industries, then you might be able to get some kind of political support with that, especially if you made it look as though that were the only reason why this code you were developing was developed, and that, and somebody might improperly use it for something else, and that's not what your purpose was.
Bill's trying to get you all to go work for Groove.
I have just one more quick question. I'm sure everybody has questions for the panel because they're all way more interesting than I am. But final question, Fred. When people have a problem, again, to my mind, their first instinct is to speed dial you all down at the EFF. You can't take every case. So just as a technical question, so people know now rather than when it's who you're going to call time, if the EFF cannot take a case, will you recommend an attorney that can help them?
Well, yeah, we'll do our best to try to find help. I mean, the reality is it's true. We have very limited resources. I'm one of four lawyers at EFF, and we have our hands very full between the DMCA and 9/11 stuff. You know, the list goes on and on and on. We do try to locate counsel when we can. Often, especially folks who are individual developers and the like, simply can't afford counsel, right? I mean, before I joined EFF, I was $300 an hour, and that's pretty average.
As a lawyer.
Right, as an attorney. So the rate's higher for a, never mind. We try to find help, and we have succeeded with many, many people, putting people in touch with attorneys who are willing to work for them for free, depending on what their circumstance is and whether they're a particularly sympathetic
So you are client. There to help.
We do our best.
Excellent. How many EFF paid-up EFF members do we have here? A lot of people.
How about the rest of you?
These are your people. The rest of you, you need to come around. So let's go straight to questions. The man in the rather fetching smock here. Let's go with him. You state your name and ask a question. Can you stand up?
Yes, I can. Well, I'm Tech, and this question is for Fred. You mentioned, and you've all talked about how it's important in the early stages of designing your app that you should consult a lawyer so you don't trip over the stairs and bang your head on some legal whatnot. What resources are available for us to discover what lawyers would be savvy in the knowledge to help us, and such that we can, talk to somebody who isn't just an ambulance chaser who doesn't know anything about the DMCA.
Right. Frankly, there's not a terribly long list I can refer you to. The real answer to that question is, especially in the early going, assuming you're not in the position to afford full bore, expensive corporate type attorneys, would be to do as much education of yourself as possible. Frankly, the entire sort of core group of cases around which all the peer-to-peer litigations have focused is not so large. And you can read them as well as anyone. And everything you do to get yourself up to a position where you can speak intelligently about the basic issues and get the sense, as Phil and John point out, that will streamline things for you when you do actually find an attorney and talk to them. The reality is, this is an issue you need to talk to an attorney who has experience with technology. These are issues that come up for a lot of people. Fortunately or unfortunately, there were a lot of dot-coms that paid to to run a lot of lawyers up this learning curve in the last 5 years. A lot of those lawyers now have some spare time on their hands. So with any luck, we've been able to pair some people up. But again, it's a tough sell, right? I mean, attorneys don't generally work for free, and they especially are cynical when the person who comes to them seems like a smart technologist rather than a blatant sort of charitable kind of a situation. So first thing, educate yourself as much as possible. Second thing, you know, find some attorneys who might be willing to sit down and, you know, they might not be willing to enter into a 100-hour consulting agreement with you, but they may very well be willing to spend a few hours to sit down and talk in general terms about these questions.
Excellent question. And that was a great technical question. If we can keep the question short, the answer short, and let's focus on real nuts and bolts stuff so people can walk away with real tools rather than feeling like they're watching another version of the Cryptographers panel.
Look, I want to add one quick thing in here. About 10 years ago, I started my own company where we were doing stuff mildly related to this, but it was online community things. And I was fortunate enough to live in town where there was a guy who, one of the lawyers there, was someone who, before he got his law degree, was a computer scientist and had even taught assembly language programming. So, you know, you could talk to him. And simply buying 3 or 4 hours of this guy's time so that he would explain all the details of how lots of things legally were put together was absolutely, utterly invaluable. And it wasn't that expensive. So, you know, doing what he was saying, if you could find a lawyer and say, I'd like, you know, to come over for an hour or two and talk about some of these issues, that can get you a lot of benefit at a relatively low cost.
Excellent. Next question.
Let's like talk a little bit about the international issues. A lot of developers don't live in the United States and aren't subject to American intellectual property laws especially, but that's a little fuzzier recently. Yeah, exactly. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
In light of the Skilyadov case, I'm not sure whether anyone is safe from U.S. IP law. Who wants to take it? John?
Okay. In my opinion, the thing that was the scariest about the Skilyadov case was, in fact, the extraterritoriality issue. And there was also what did this program do, but also the where was it done sort of thing. And the DMCA is itself the U.S. implementation of the WIPO treaty, which is an international treaty for intellectual property. I have been told by friends in the U.K. that there is a U.K. version of this that is much more draconian than the U.S. one. But because of cultural reasons, people don't really care that much about it in the UK, and it doesn't get a lot of press, and people don't even really understand it that well. There will be European Union versions of this. I know there are versions in Australia and New Zealand being done. So you really have to pay close attention to what is going on in your country, because it may actually turn out that your country is less friendly than the US.
Fred, other than just never stepping foot inside the United States, what do our international developers have?
Yeah. Well, let me just make a couple of quick points on that. First, the United States government recently, just last week, filed a brief in the Elcomsoft case in which it argued expressly that the DMCA has extraterritorial reach. So it's the position of the United States that is the law. They go on to say we don't need to reach that in the Elcomsoft case because they sold products into the United States, et cetera, et cetera. But they have definitely taken a strong position that the DMCA reaches overseas. The second point, to echo what John just finished with, the reality is the United States, we are not the worst when it comes to copyright law. Copyright law has been expanding overseas internationally as well. In fact, in some ways, U.S. copyright law as applied to technology is friendlier than many foreign laws because we have a very vibrant and powerful technology corporate community that has carved out some protections that you might not have if you were the first person to end up, say, in front of a Dutch court, as the folks who build Kazaa found out. So you know, it's something to consider. Obviously, if you're shipping code into the United States, if you travel to the United States, if you have bank accounts in the United States, those issues obviously may make your extraterritoriality less helpful as a shield as well. So, exactly. Well, I do point out to people that one of the few countries that was not a member of all the international copyright conventions was Afghanistan. I fully expect that that will change shortly.
Zuko has a question.
My name is Zuko, and I'm an independent nonprofit hacker working on an open source project. This project has its intent is a non-infringing thing, which is an internet shared file system. And all I do is I write source code. I don't operate any servers. So I'm good, right? I'm good, right? I can relax.
Not quite so simple. One of the questions is, well, is anybody using the code? All right. So it's shipped and people are using it. Yeah. Question becomes, what are they using it for? Well, don't tell me. I'm just saying that's the question. I don't necessarily want you to tell me what your knowledge is with respect to that right here. But just because you had the best of intentions and just because you are only writing the code and not actually running it or using it yourself may not be the end of the story. The relevant questions are, you know, and this is laid out in more detail in the paper I mentioned, but couple of questions. Do you have the right and ability to control any of your end users? That may include something as trivial as, do you ship the code with an end user license agreement? Now, if you're open source, then it's maybe the GPL or another license, but that's something to think about. Courts have said efforts to use licensing agreements to have the right to terminate or otherwise discipline end users could give rise to at least legal control. It may at least be enough to drag you into court and run up the bill. So issues like that may matter. Did you have knowledge that people were out there using it for infringing purposes, and did you materially contribute to that? So even if you're not yourself doing it, if you know that a bunch of people out there, especially if you know that there are specific people out there who are using it for specific unlawful acts, that can be troubling. So my general advice, and I lay this out in the paper as well, is the way the law is developing right now in copyright, there's a strong incentive for you to know absolutely nothing about what your end users are up to, have absolutely no way of controlling or influencing what they do. The rule that I like to say is you want to be to your end users exactly how Xerox is to the people who buy their photocopiers at retail. Right. Once that thing gets shipped, the person who bought the photocopier never has to call Xerox again and ask to make the next copy. They never get an upgrade from Xerox. I think live updating is a big danger in this area. I would avoid it. They never have to call Xerox to say, where do I buy toner? Xerox has no idea what they're photocopying, how many copies they're making, what happens to those copies. So the more you look like Sony did with the VCR or Xerox with a photocopier, I think the better off you are. Now, for peer-to-peer file sharing, there are some problems that are hard to work out in that issue. Bootstrapping is probably the biggest one. How do you find the first peer to connect to is something that a lot of engineers gravitate toward solving that problem for their users by either creating a reflector, as in the Nutella situation, running a reflector, or somehow otherwise helping the user join the network.
Right, we've got a follow-up question.
I worry that that's the kind of choice that you want to think hard about. So anyway, I hope that helps answer your question. It's not enough to just say, oh, I only code, I don't run it. That doesn't quite get you all the way there. You still want to understand the law.
So follow up
to... I'd like to say that for something like that, as an example of legal intuition, is that that information of how do I get to the first peer should be in a separate config file. That way the software
which has all that engineering effort and all that engineering liability, potential liability, is decoupled from it. Yes. Somebody else could supply the configuration file.
Yes, disaggregating functions is almost always a good idea. This urge to say, oh, well, I want to give my users a chat function and a bulletin board function and a bootstrapping function and, you know, find out what the order of album tracks is so they can download whole albums at a time function. Very bad idea. The more you integrate, the more connection you have with your users, the more control you gather. And that, to my mind, is always a bad development.
I'd also recommend that you try to take what territory you can as soon as you can. Let me give you an example. There was that case where there was an academic paper that was going to be presented at a conference containing information about breaking a digital rights management scheme. And the author of the paper declined to proceed. He was afraid he might be sued, so he withdrew his paper. Well, you know, I don't know, maybe there's some reason why he did that in some high strategic sense because he wanted to have some litigation to win or something like that. I don't know. But if it was me, I would have published the paper because then you seize some territory. It's just like publishing the book from MIT Press with the PGP source code. We seize some territory. MIT Press applied for a commodities jurisdiction to export it, but then they exported it anyway. They didn't wait for a reply. They just exported it because they have warehouses and resellers in London and other countries. So they just exported it. And that's what, you know, you could do that. You go ahead and publish the paper in areas that you know are safe, that your gut tells you, your instincts tell you. Maybe in some kind of excessively anal interpretation of the law, it's not safe. If you think, well, theoretically, they could sue me over this. Well, you know, screw that. You know, the fact is that nobody is going to sue MIT for publishing a book. Absolutely no one will do that. And you have to know that. You have to have the common sense to see that. And you know, if you're going to publish an academic paper at a conference with a bunch of mathematicians talking about how to break, you know, talking about weaknesses in a digital rights management scheme because we should be talking about weaknesses and things, so that we can fix them and repair them and make them better to protect those MPAA, you know, organizations that need protection.
And on that note, the gentleman in the back had a very interesting follow-up question. Is where do the people who are participating as peers have put up some server space that they're not really watching and monitoring what's going on in that server, but they're part of the network? What kind of liability do they have? Because as we all know, if you have friends who are writing code and deploying stuff, you want to help them out. You want them to connect. But is it possible that you're getting your friends into trouble? What kind of liability is out there, Fred?
That's certainly a possibility. I mean, I like to isolate all the potential targets that might be out there. There is, of course, the end user. The end user is always a possible target. The fact that the copyright industries have not chosen to litigate against an end user yet, there's no guarantee they won't. Network intermediaries are also a potential target. The copyright industries have not chosen to litigate against ISPs yet. They could if they wanted to. Similarly, if you are performing a network intermediary role, there is some possibility that same copyright rules apply. Did you know? Were you materially contributing? Did you have control? Were you gaining a financial benefit? The same general tests apply. So, something to think about. I also like to point out that providing ancillary services can also put you in hot water. There's a case that a lot of people aren't paying much attention to anymore involving a search engine called mp3board.com. They were a straight-up MP3 search engine doing the same thing that Lycos and many other big search engine companies do. The one difference was that they searched the Nutella space and provided search results in linkable form that allowed downloads from Nutella. They basically ran a Nutella node as part of their search engine. That got them sued. They are still stuck in litigation. It's been, I think, almost 2 years now. All they did was provide search functionality into a network that was built by AOL Time Warner, ironically enough.
Got an excellent question here. So.
Do you actually have any recommendations of where, if I want to maximize my freedom of speech, what countries should I move to? What is the best jurisdiction for me to live? Where is that?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm just an American lawyer, right? We're doing our best to protect those rights at home, but I don't know. And the reality is, how many countries in the world have good internet connectivity? How many countries in the world do you want to live in? How many countries in the world would let you immigrate? I mean, I'd rather fight some of these fights here, because for better or for worse, this is where I live.
It's better to stay and fight.
This is our country.
There's another issue too, which is that, as I said before, this is not the worst country there is on things, and this country has an attitude towards not only helping the little person, but helping small businesses over large businesses. I mean, remember that the big cases that have gone on in the past, like the Sony Betamax case, like a number of other things, have come down always on the side of enabling people to do things that are reasonable. So a compromise may happen here better than it would happen in some other country where they are much more tied to things like industry demands.
So I'm going to try to introduce a little bit of practicality here, because I think that's very important. And I won't be very long, Bill, so chill out. I run a nonprofit corporation, California Corporate Public Benefit Nonprofit Corporation, with a 501c3, by the way. So if you're not a member of Crypto Rights and you're not a member of EFF, you're screwing up if you're at this place and trying to do this kind of work. So join one of the two organizations. But the point that I'm trying to make is we have an overall architecture, and we're designing a hardware-software combination for use by human rights workers with the parallel goal of providing a good explanation for why this kind of work that you guys are doing has a human rights value to the world. And this is extra jurisdictional, okay? Now, if you are smart, like John Gilmore, and you want to get something written which could be interpreted in various different ways, and you want to choose how it's going to be interpreted by the rest of the world so that you don't have these kind of legal hassles, then you will come to the Crypto Rights, talk to me, and we will figure out a way to integrate what you're doing, which definitely does require some P2P stuff, into our overall project architecture, so that if there's ever a question about somebody misusing your software for illegal purposes, you will have a very big push, you know, puffy pillow to fall back on with a whole bunch of other people, and you can argue very reasonably, I think, that you are part of a large group of people producing a very useful and needed thing for the human rights of the world, and that people shouldn't come at you for some small little thing that somebody's doing with your software that's bad. So please come to the Cyberpunks meeting tonight, and we can talk about this some more, and get my card. I have several of them with me, and tell me what you're doing, and we'll try and figure out how we can integrate it. This is a practical solution to what's being talked about here. And, you know, we have lawyers, and in fact our law firm is the firm that worked where Cindy Cohn used to work, and that was, you know, responsible for her pro bono work on the Bernstein case. So we also have good legal people to talk to, and we're friendly with the EFF. And if it gets really hairy, you know, we'll find you the right people to talk to.
Excellent. Thank you for the infomercial, Dave. All right.
Anyone with a question? Question.
Fred, further to your point about not controlling what your users do, is that a general damning of agorics and ratios in peer-to-peer networks?
Yeah, there are certain impulses among the peer-to-peer development community that I completely understand from an engineering point of view, or I should say people have explained to me, so I understand them vaguely enough, but that nevertheless, as an attorney, make me nervous. Efforts to, you know, really control what kinds of users are allowed on and what users aren't allowed on, oftentimes I see this expressed as a question of no freeloaders. There's a real effort to cut freeloaders out. I'm not saying that's always bad, but the more your urge to efficient network architecture leads to having direct on-off control over individual end users, the more it looks like you can control what they're up to. And, you know, it's something to think about. I like decentralization. I have been in many debates with developers about the technical merits of hybrid architectures and centralization makes sense in certain places and all the rest. But legally, I like decentralization. I like disaggregation of functionality. I don't think there's any real reason why everybody, why one project should, danger. Why one project should try to solve the whole problem itself, you know, solve file sharing and search and metadata and, you know, I think there are technical reasons why one project shouldn't do it either, but there are definitely legal reasons.
I have another question.
Yeah, I'm Robert Kay from Music Brains, and this question is for Fred. You talked about legal issues concerning live update. Could you please elaborate on that?
Yeah, I've been telling developers this for a while. I think it's dangerous to have a live updating feature in your code, the ability to push down updates on your end users, on your clients. I certainly think it's dangerous if it's a no-option update. Well, I was about to say, I don't like the push option. I think that's very bad, where the end user never doesn't have a choice. It just happens automatically. I also am not comfortable with a pull. I don't like the box pops open and says, click here to live update this code to the latest version. I'd much rather, you know, if you want to send the user an email that says, hey, there's a new version, here's where you can go download it and reinstall it, fine. But I don't, it really creates an opportunity for the other side to say, you have control. You could push down a kill switch. And if you don't push down the kill switch, you know, you're just willfully choosing not to exercise the control you have.
John,
much
what
better
do you
to
make
say, I can't push anything down.
What do you make of that, John?
Okay, here, this is something that is a principle that I have used when I've tried to deal and navigate these things, is that you have the obligation, whenever you set out to start doing stuff, to do it well. And if you say you're going to do it, you have to do it correctly. And it doesn't matter what this is, and people will hit you for it. For example, years ago, we ended up with various ISPs wanting to do, you know, like, do you want to see things that would upset you? And if you are going to provide the service that you are going to not upset people, you have to actually not upset them. And if they turn out to be upset, then you may be liable for that. Similarly, on something like this, if you provide a mechanism where you can do things like Agorix and you can punish freeloaders, well, if somebody else believes, like a court believes, that their freeloaders are the people who didn't pay for this, then you will have the obligation to punish those freeloaders. So if you design your system so that you can punish bad people, then somebody may come up with a different definition of what's bad and cause you to do that. So this is sort of the technical aspect of some of the things that Fred's saying. And the way that I think about it is that when you set out to do something, you have to do it well. And if somebody else comes up with a different meter of good-bad, then you're going to have to toe to that, especially if it's a court.
Lucky Green had a quick...
Let me add one more point. Let me echo what Phil said, and I think it was exactly right. Eudora created an open plugin API Qualcomm created it for Eudora. I think there's a lot of merit to open documented APIs to allow people, again, it's part of the same theme of decentralization and disaggregating functionality. And you can say, listen, I built this thing that is used by lots of people for lots of purposes, and if somebody else built something that helped people do unlawful things, well, all I did was publish an API. It could have been used for translating and spell checking just as easily as it could have been used for implementing a crypto plugin.
Hi, I'm Lucky Green. I've been involved with cryptography on almost a daily basis ever since being a beta tester of PGP 2.0 so many years ago. And there are actually two small comments I would like to make. One is to echo what the panel now has gotten into. I'm not an attorney licensed to practice law in the state of California, but having been involved in it for so many years, there are two things to keep in mind that I believe are absolutely critical to keep yourself out of trouble. The first one is you need to subpoena proof yourself. What does that mean? It means that when the subpoena comes in, say, shut down the service, your users are doing something bad, the only appropriate and only acceptable response is, I am unable to do so. I would like nothing more in my life but to comply with this order, but I am physically unable to do so. That's the position you need to be in. The second is, If you're working on technologies that may upset those, be that the government or those in power or the media corporations, whatever the case may be, for Christ's sakes, get yourself an attorney before you even ship the first line of code. I have never been, I've never received as much as a speeding ticket. I have two criminal defense law firms on retainer and had so for at least 8 years. You don't have to get two law firms, but at least get one.
Good points. We've got time for
Let me just add one spin to that.
Go.
Although I do agree that if you are running an ISP or other network intermediary type function, that the subpoena proofing yourself may be a sensible approach. I don't think it's a sensible approach if you are, as Zuko is, the actual developer. Because if you go to the court and say, sorry, I automatically delete every single email the instant I send it, and I delete every email I receive within 30 minutes of receiving it, and also PGP disk over it so it's completely unrecoverable by any forensic tools. Well, that's not really, I don't think that looks real innocent. And I don't think a court will think that either. And so I think you're much better off understanding the law in the first place, understanding what, you know, that you have a good defense and living up to it, right? I mean, every email you send should, you know, represent your point of view, just as Phil said. You know, he exercise discipline. Understand where you are and exercise discipline and how you talk about your project so that when your emails get discovered, they support what you're going to say, you know, on the stand.
All right, we're down to the final three questions. Quick questions, quick answers, and then we'll wrap up so we can all do something useful like drink heavily. So, number three.
Okay, clearly legitimacy of your service is important in the sense of Google gets to go ahead and search everything, including perhaps serial numbers for applications, while MP3 board goes down. But it seems to me that it's a little excessive to say you need to have a lawyer approve your network diagram. If nothing else, is not the law itself forged by what's out there in the field and what people themselves have determined are legitimate?
Phil, that's all you.
I don't know. What do you mean? Could you ask that question again?
If you had gone to the government and said, hi, U.S. government, can I write PGP and, you know, spread triple desk to the masses? They would have shut you down in advance, and we would not have the crypto law we have
today. It's always better to beg forgiveness afterward than to ask permission before. That's my credo. But I don't think that talking to my own lawyer, I don't let my lawyer determine everything that I do. Rather, I listen to what he has to say, listen to him describe the legal threat model, you know. I mean, there's cryptanalytic threat models, but there's also legal threat models. And then I try to devise some kind of countermeasures to that with his advice.
All right, got a second to last question.
I would just echo that.
Okay, quick question. There's a lot of people in this room. Everybody has legal problems. Let's try to start like a legal insurance, right? We all just pay $100 a month. Maybe it's to the EFF, but next time we have a problem, we have legal lawyers on retainer.
I suggest that Fred, being an upstanding citizen, is going to probably be in a corner someplace, so everyone with specific legal questions can just, Fred, we own you to 5:30, brother. All right, final question.
I'm sorry, this is a somewhat of a specific legal question. Could you comment on the possibility of the United States government or other agency putting pressure on developers to change the behavior of their programs?
Who wants to take that?
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
I think what he's referring to is that it would be the new speak, new thought approach to change the way programmers think so you don't think ungood thoughts before you write.
Oh, yeah.
Additional decryption keys.
All right, let's get a better question. Who's got a really good last question? Here we go. He does.
I'll take a short crack at that. Right. There is certainly an effort underway. The government, I think, has more or less given up on the notion that they're going to force down key escrow on the whole world through secure phones. Thankfully, I think that's gone away. But I think we are seeing a strong effort now to force digital rights management technologies onto all kinds of digital technologies, including software. The SSSCA, Senator Holling's bill, is just the clearest example of that. Amen. But the place where it's happening, where I hope all of you, you know, keep your eyes open, is in standards bodies. We're really trying to fight this effort to get technologies, including hard drives through the ATA bodies and digital output through HDCP, and all these places, they're trying to, copyright industries are showing up and asking standards bodies to implement, to require as part of the standard, digital rights management technologies. The second half of that is they will ban any technology that is non-compliant, which is definitely coming down the pipe. And so that would leave us in a position where the government would say to you, you must code, you must include these modules or this functionality in your code. If you do not, you are a criminal.
And you will enjoy it.
That's right. What we're trying to stop. So right.
We have the final question, and it's a good one.
One more thing I want to add to that. A powerful tool is consumer revolt. Don't buy things that...
Hear, hear. Hear, hear.
There are devices out there that have stuff in them that I don't like, and I won't buy them.
John, you're just too cool because you answered the last guy's final question. So since we've just got a couple of minutes, isn't that cool? Since we've just got literally a couple of minutes, let's go around very quickly. Fred, Phil, John, the one point you want everyone to walk away with. Fred.
If you are building a product that may be misused by your end users to infringe copyright, you must, I think, learn something about copyright law. Start developing the legal sense. I know it's a hassle. I know it's boring and awful, but I really think it's crucial that you start developing that sense before you dive in.
Phil?
Yeah, and of course, join the FF.
Right. Phil.
Thank you, Brad.
I think you can, if you can develop a good common sense, good instincts, you can wind your way through the legal system and topple castle walls. If you have that sense, if you don't succumb to the temptation to being a little too radicalized or shrill about it, but develop a sense of what will sell, what will sell politically, what will the kind of soft path through the system that doesn't invite attack. That's, we've won the crypto war because of tactics like I'm describing.
John Callis.
Don't build stuff that's obviously illegal. That sounds stupid, but design your system so that you know that it's got legitimate uses and that the legitimate uses are things that lots of people will want, and don't associate with the people who are going to want to use it for bad purposes. That stay away from them even if you agree with them. Actually, especially if you agree with them.
And my lesson is that direct action really does work. I think that's the lesson that Paul Holman and myself learned when we started the Boycott Adobe movement, is that sometimes it's not worthwhile to go after the government. It's worthwhile to go where the money is. And that if enough geeks get out in the sun, that we can do some pretty cool stuff. The EFF needs Malcolm X out there by whatever means necessary to help them with the job. I'd like to thank our three panelists, Fred von Lehmann, Lohmann, Mr. Phil Zimmerman, and the ever lovely John Callis. I'm Bill Scannell. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for playing.
It's an honor being on a panel.
Thank you, Bill. And, there's a lot of mention of signing up and supporting the EFF. We have a collection as you leave the door. If you would like to donate to the EFF, please throw what you can into the box there. people headed to the Cypherpunks meeting should follow Dave Del Torto and... Cyberpunk's meeting is at Don Ramon's, the Mexican restaurant, which is about two blocks down the road. There will be a procession of people leading there soon.